So good morning again, everyone. It is just so great to be here. I'm sure you all appreciate how wonderful this place is, even if, like me, you were spoiled and grew up in a similarly wonderful place. Just incredible to be able to run on Monterey Bay in the morning and then talk about the stuff that we all love, crazy as we may be to love it. Just a housekeeping note. My idea regarding office hours was to sort of do them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I saw that, and the reason for that is I don't want to hem us in on Friday's simulation, and then Monday, Tuesday next week, my parents are not here in town, so I need to be available after class to help with the kids. So I saw that we have three slots filled today and tomorrow, so if there's anyone else, I told Nathan to add, you know, at least one more slot today, one more slot tomorrow, but I'm happy to stick around as necessary today and tomorrow, so just make sure if you want to sit down and talk. I totally get it, right? Careers in D.C., jobs, I'm more than happy to, whatever advice I have, connections and so forth, to offer that up, but so please sign up on the Facebook thing. I'll check it, and I will be in Anna's outer office after class today. The idea of today's lecture is quite different from Monday's and yesterday's, in that this is really keyed to give you not so much cultural literacy as almost institutional operational literacy in three key institutions of the Euro-Atlantic space, and that's distinct from what you would call the Eurasian or Euro-Asian space, although OSCE bridges those two. And as you can guess from the flags, it's the European Union, NATO, and the OSCE. And really, I'm literally going to give you a crash course in how these you know, oftentimes very abstruse international bureaucracies work, or at least to the degree that you need to know, and then a little bit about kind of the history and origins of them. And all of this is really geared towards, of course, your simulation on Friday, where you need to be thinking about institutionalizing rules, right? Because rules don't mean anything when there's no one to enforce them, or when there's no one to sort of monitor them, follow them, and implement them. You know, the old saying, where you sit is where you stand, right? You create institutions which embody values or embody rules, and all of a sudden you have a bunch of stakeholders who care about those rules. And when you don't have such institutions, you tend not to have such stakeholders as much. So that's what I want to do with this, and then I'll conclude with sensitivity to the clock with a kind of introduction to, I think, where Fyodor will go, and that will be the concept on a much more theoretical or just at least conceptual level of a Euro-Atlantic security community. How do I think about that? Fyodor has said a few words about that already. I'm going to give you even some direct pulls from the project that he and I worked on jointly, 6 years ago now, the Euro-Atlantic Security Initiative, and warm you up for Fyodor. And then I think we'll once again do joint Q&A. I think that seems to work rather well. So, okay, let's start with the European Union. This map is, of course, very familiar to all of you. The color coding may be a little bit more of a blast from the past, because, you know, we tend to think about the European Union today as just Europe, right? I mean, they're almost one and the same. But, of course, we know that for the bulk of the European Union's history, that was, in fact, not the case. The European Union more or less has its origins in the decade or so after World War II, when the European Coal and Steel Community is formed, 1958. That's France, Germany, Italy, and the Benelux countries. They're known at the time as sort of the Inner Six, and even since then. And there are two basic goals to doing this. Now, you know, why coal and steel? A decade after World War II, right? Why do you unify coal and steel markets?
Because those are typically some of the more important commodities for, like, war.
Right. These are the raw materials for war, basically, for the war machines, the sort of the economic engine. Remember, of course, the big fight over the Rhineland, you know, Germany's industrial heartland. You know, who controls the ability to sort of drive the economics of war? And the idea is basically two main things. You unify these countries around something in common, it's a way of taking a little bit of the steam out of nationalist politics, which of course, you know, barely a decade before had been the author of Europe's near destruction. And then of course, to prevent the kind of mechanics of waging a war from being possible in the hands of any one national leadership.
I don't know what.
That's okay. I thought that was, we hear every morning from the Presidio, we hear their, you know, revelry, and then at night we hear taps. I thought that's a little late for today, but okay. So then in 1967, the so-called merger occurs into the European Community. In 1973, three important new members join, Denmark, Ireland, and the UK. That was a long time ago. In the 1980s, Greece, Portugal, and Spain join, of course, all three of them having been delayed for related reasons, which has to do with their post-World War II kind of authoritarian, communist, et cetera, flirtations. But, you know, the theory being now that they are democracies like the rest of Europe, they can be part of the European Community. In 1985, the Schengen Agreement on Open Borders begins its process, not fully into force. But in 1993, Maastricht creates the European Union, more or less as we know it today, although it evolves radically, and I'll tell you more about that. In 1995, Austria, Finland, and Sweden join. And in 2002, the euro currency is introduced. Again, because of the extensive adoption of the euro, it's not the entire EU by any measure, but it is, you know, common enough in Europe that you can, as you all know, you can travel around and have a few, you know, tens of euros on your person and be pretty much fine in most of this space. So we tend to think of these things as interchangeable, but it's really important to think about the European Union as maybe sort of electron valence rings, right? To use a metaphor from chemistry and physics, or some kind of, you know, multi-lane superhighway, something like that, where there really are different layers of integration in which not all nations are involved. But if you look at the overlap on these two maps, note who is pretty much always in the picture, that inner six, right? That inner six, and that legacy goes right back to the Second World War. And that is vitally important to remember. I think now, 70 years later, it's very common, especially for us at far removed here in the United States, to sort of forget the origins of the European Union is not so much in the European Union as it is today, as a kind of geopolitical actor, maybe, as a massive trading bloc, definitely, as the euro currency. It is very much in these two ideas, fighting nationalism or preventing nationalism from becoming dominant in any one country's politics, and preventing the instruments for supporting and waging war being concentrated in the hands of any one country. Okay, then of course there are further rounds of expansion and sort of also a wider net cast in the wider European neighborhood. 2004, you have a big round, Cyprus, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Hungary, Malta, Poland, Slovakia, Slovenia, right? So that's when the map starts to resemble, you know, this, the blue that we know today as being more or less all of Europe, and the outliers are outliers by choice rather than by exclusion, with some important exceptions like Ukraine, obviously, which we'll talk more about. In 2007, Romania and Bulgaria joined. Does anybody know why Romania and Bulgaria were delayed behind the big 2004 round? So I always say,
is it because of like freedom of movement? They're kind of poor, so they didn't want them at all.
That's an even better answer than I was going to give. So that, yes, there's a level on which that's true, this sort of general story. But that would also be true about Turkey, for example. And yet Turkey was never admitted and probably never will be. The official reason, and I think to some extent the real reason with respect to Romania and Bulgaria, is what I always say in my Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus classes. You should always come prepared to class, but if you're not and you don't know the answer, 80% it's going to be corruption. So just say corruption. And Romania and Bulgaria received essentially a special program from the European Union. Their corruption was assessed to be so bad, so deeply ingrained, they received a bunch of funding and a special program to combat corruption. And then they're often looked at today, especially when it comes to the Ukraines, the Moldovas, the Georgias of the world, as being these kind of poster children of how you institutionally combat corruption. I'm not sure that that's true, but anyway, they got into the European Union in 2007, and it's been more than 10 years, and the others have not yet. So further rounds of expansion, there's kind of a concept that comes right around the same time as the lobbying campaign to join the European Union on the part of, in particular, the former communist states of what I grew up not that long ago in the 1980s thinking of as Eastern Europe, to rebrand themselves as the new Central Europe. Geographically, I'm not sure if that's right or wrong. I think it really depends on where you draw lines. And as I've said before in this class, line drawing is really not that important of an exercise. But for branding purposes, kind of these countries have identified themselves as the new Central Europe. And this really does have a pretty important psychological and political weight, not only in a sense of common interests across this region. Certainly there are variations, but what you tend to find is, at least with respect to relations with Russia, at least with respect to the conflict in Ukraine, with respect to policy towards sanctions or energy, you tend to find a relatively common position across these folks who have defined themselves as the new Central Europe. Now, you'll notice that Germany is also shaded in that picture. Maybe the fact that it's like light blue is because it's a marginal case. It's sort of, there are ways in which Germany sometimes seems like it is breaking with a half-century post-war tradition of being kind of the quintessential Western European power, and then there are other ways, and I don't mean to box you in for Friday's simulation, but there are other ways in which Germany remains very consistent in that path. Okay. And then, of course, we have the Balkan states. Serbia, Croatia, Macedonia, Kosovo, Albania. The Western Balkans is still a work in progress. However, as you can see, sort of moving down the map, Slovenia has been in Croatia, and then eventually, I think the entire former Yugoslavia will be admitted. There doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of controversy over that. Montenegro, maybe Serbia are the last bastions where there seems to be a battle of identities going on. But just given geography, it's kind of hard to make the case here. And we'll talk about Montenegro's recent accession to NATO in a moment. But this is not really overwhelmingly the focus of our course. The outermost, you might say, valence ring of European Union-ness is these neighborhood policies. The idea that the European Union is not an island by definition, right? It has for thousands of years been intimately linked to North Africa. And here you have the so-called southern neighborhood in that gold color, as well as, of course, to the Eurasian landmass in the form of the eastern neighborhood. Now, the Eastern Neighborhood Policy is something that came out of roughly the mid to late 2000s. It was, in some ways, a complement to a policy line that had been developing since the 1990s, which was an effort to fulfill the vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace expressed by Bush and Gorbachev, and, of course, supported by Helmut Kohl and others eventually. But this was the institutionalization of it. And it came with various kinds of documents. An Eastern partnership was announced in 2009, which included three countries, explicitly not Russia, although Russia is nominally part of the Eastern neighborhood. The six countries are, of course, Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, and then the three South Caucasus republics. So they're all former Soviet republics. They are all, four out of them border directly on Russia. Four out of the six also have territorial or separatist conflicts, and they are all lumped together in this Eastern Partnership idea. Now, the names, the terminology is not vitally important. What's important here is that this is the somewhat ham-fisted way in which the bureaucrats of the European Union set about putting an incredibly ambitious civilizational marker, out there, right? So, you know, if you thought about an American leader or an American government approach to this topic, it would be a big speech, right? It would be President Clinton speaking on Sofievska Square in Kiev, saying basically, this is a European country, you are Europe, you are the West, right? And then it would be probably a bunch of American military assistance, and financial assistance and USAID and so forth. And over time, basically, it would become clear that this is, you know, part of our space. And there's clearly a geopolitical dimension to that. And Fyodor will talk a lot more about that. For the European Union, it is a much different process. It's a kind of bureaucratic ladder. The action plans implicit in the European Eastern Partner the Eastern Neighborhood and the Eastern Partnership Program entail a whole bunch of components, the best known of which, of course, you mentioned this earlier, free travel, right? The idea that you have to meet a bunch of very explicit, very detailed requirements. I mean, literally down to exactly how your passport is designed with biometric information. Can it be scanned in certain ways? How do you verify you know, obviously that it can't be counterfeited, but that the person who goes in the first place to get that passport is in fact that person when you are coming out of a post-Soviet, sometimes territorial conflict, right? I mean, you've got literally millions of citizens across those six republics whose actual citizenship is unclear, right? Maybe they even still have Soviet passports. Right? Maybe they have taken on, for example, Romanian citizenship if they're Transnistrians out of convenience. You know, who knows? Maybe they have Turkish citizenship if they're Gagauzians. So how do you figure out how to implement a passport and sort of identity control system that allows completely free travel without visas into and out of the European Union? It's a big deal. The Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement, DCFTA, that's a weird bureaucratic term that we've heard an awful lot about. But it also is incredibly, this is a 10,000-page agreement in the case of Ukraine and the European Union. A friend of mine actually was the lead negotiator of this for the Ukrainian side. And she has explained and confirmed to me that although there is definitely a kind of propagandized anti-European, anti-Western narrative about this that says, oh my God, you know, our basic essence, who we are as Ukrainians, is being wrenched away from us because our street signs have to conform to certain rules. And, you know, the way we label our fruits and vegetables and even the way that we grow them, which is the essence of an agrarian society, it all has to be changed. But on the other hand, that's actually true. That really is actually true, because all of this is written into phytosanitary standards, so health and safety, standards for packaging and marketing. And then ultimately, it all comes down to money, right? Where does the advantage lie with producers of different kinds of products? That is the biggest difficulty in negotiating something like free trade, because if you simply open the floodgates of free trade. You say, free trade, sorry, I'm not doing basics here. You guys know it means no tariffs, right? You don't add a penalty, a cost at the border when, say, tomatoes come in from Mexico. But of course, as we know in this country, given the debate of the last couple of years, you know, a lot of people are afraid of free trade, and with good reason, right? It can literally overnight, it can obliterate domestic industries, and with those go jobs, and then you really do have social collapse. And so Europe, of course, has its own industries that compete with industries in these six countries. If you think in particular about the bigger economies here, right, Ukraine would be the biggest, but Belarus is also quite significant. Azerbaijan, certainly in terms of energy, you know, they're producing a lot of industrial goods, you know, metal, pipes, concrete, forest products, and then, of course, tons and tons of agriculture, and they're doing it all with much lower input costs. So one of the goals for the Europeans, aside from ensuring the health, safety, et cetera, standards, is to make sure that the costs are somewhat comparable. So especially, and this is where the interests of this sort of new Central Europe group is so critical, right? Because the ones who are going to get killed, not so much the French, you know, or the Germans at the end of the day, it's these folks whose costs have already jumped up by 2 or 3x and who are competing directly in some of the same industries. Okay, so Anyway, you put together DCFTA, free travel, a political association agreement. That's just sort of a lot of rhetoric that says we share the same values, we share the same democratic political systems, etc. And you get what's called a European association or a European neighborhood agreement, which is understood, and this is vitally important, to be, you know, the major waypoint on the road to EU membership. That is vitally important. Okay, so what does it mean if you ultimately get into the EU? What have you bought yourself access to? It is an elite club full of frumpy bureaucrats. I'm kidding. These are wonderful people. I've actually come to know Kathy Ashton personally. She is the coolest person ever. She always says, call me Kathy, even though she's Baroness Catherine Ashton. She is the Baroness, by the way, of a modest bungalow somewhere in the north of England. I think that's very cool, but that's how the British system works, I guess. So the Treaty of Lisbon in 2009 is simply an intergovernmental executive agreement that's signed by the leaders of the then EU countries. And it creates this whole bureaucracy where basically the EU starts to look more, I mean, if we're just very direct about it, more like the United States, right? It has basically a federal type structure. It has a foreign minister, Lady Ashton, with an external action service, i.e. a State Department. It has these two presidents, the president of the commission and the president of the council, but you can almost think of it like a president and a prime minister because they do ultimately divide their competencies. What's interesting to me about the whole phenomenon of Lisbon is that it even happens in the first place. Because you may recall, you guys might have been in high school at the time, but you may recall that there was a referendum across the European Union about whether they should do this in the first place. Should they have a constitution? Should they move towards European federalism? And the referendum was defeated. The European voters, especially the French, but also others, said, hell no, we don't want this. And the European leaders did it anyway. And to me, this is somehow a warning sign, right? That the direction that this sort of supranational bureaucracy is moving may not be fully accounting for the realities of domestic politics. Now, that said, an important bit of historical context. If you were to do public opinion surveys in Germany and France in the 1950s, the majority of people would also have opposed European integration. They actually did not support it, and they actually had dramatically different characterizations of what the lessons of the Second World War were than they did 20 or 30 years later. And so many of the proponents of European integration argue that this is very much a horse and a cart, right? If you build it, they will come, right? If you force yourself to think positive thoughts, you will feel positive emotions. Right? You heard that. That's a basic psychological advice. So the idea is the leaders knew better. And in 2009, they imposed the constitution on Europe, essentially. They didn't call it a constitution. They called it a treaty. But all of these European states, a technical legal point, all of these European states, unlike the United States, have self-executing international law provisions in their own constitutions, which means in the United States, if we sign a treaty, the Senate has to vote in order to make that treaty part of U.S. domestic law. In European states, if a treaty is signed, it automatically becomes part of domestic law, and it supersedes all other domestic law. So by treaty, they were able to create a constitution which binds all European states. And it has these various functions. Since 2014, by the way, there is a second generation of officials in each of these places. The new president of the European Council is Donald Tusk, the former Polish prime minister. The new president of the commission is Jean-Claude Juncker, the former prime minister of Luxembourg. And the new high representative of the External Action Service is Federica Mogherini, former Italian foreign minister. And what's interesting, by the way, in the case of many of these officials is that they're often chosen because there is still so much of a tension between national political authority and Europe-wide kind of federal, for lack of a better term, authority. They're often chosen as compromise candidates, as people who are maybe not going to be threatening to the individual national foreign policies or the individual national financial and monetary policies. In fact, it often works out the other way. So Kathy Ashton is a great example where she basically totally broke the mold of what a European foreign minister could be. I mean, she was out there in many instances. She frankly outperformed her American counterparts, and was vital on, you know, the Iran nuclear deal and many other big international achievements. I think the jury is still out on Mogherini. And similarly, I mean, Tusk has been very visible. His legacy is not yet clear. But Barroso, for example, the former president of the European Commission, was also, I think, quite a strong figure. All right, so this concept of a wider Europe is not just about the Eastern Partnership, these six countries. The theory is to prevent new dividing lines, to promote stability, security, and prosperity, and in principle to offer some version of connectivity with institutional Europe to basically anybody who wants it. So, although it has become very difficult in practice given the refugee crisis coming from North Africa and the Levant, there even are various versions of travel and trade facilitation agreements with the South. Just important to see that in context. All right. So much for the European Union. NATO. NATO has its origins right around the same period. In particular, in the late 1940s, the 1948 Berlin blockade, leading to the airlift by the United States and the Allied powers. And in 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty is signed in Washington, known at that time as the Treaty of Washington, not so much anymore. And it has various articles, the two most important of which, at least one of which you will have heard of, one maybe not so much, both you need to know. Article 5, which is? Louder. Right. So an attack against one is an attack against all, right? And collective defense as opposed to collective security, right? It's collective security. We'll talk about the difference between those a little bit more, but collective defense is an attack against one is an attack against all. That is to say, we all collectively deter attackers in the first place because they know if they mess with me, they're messing with all of us, and they don't want to have that problem on their hands. And of course, the they in question is the Soviet Union. and then Article 10. Who knows what Article 10 is? Anyone? No? So Article 10 is the open door article. And this is obviously important because just like the European Union, NATO expands in multiple rounds over time. And Article 10 essentially says that we are open to new members that, and the details here are important, that share our kind of democratic system of values and that are in our interest to admit, right? So there's not a right to join NATO, but there is an enshrined open door. So you can't close the door, and the conditions on which the door is open and to whom are stipulated in the NATO treaty, but it doesn't guarantee anyone accession. The first Secretary General of NATO, a British Lord, says, Lord Ismay, says that the goal of NATO, famously, and this is a sort of paraphrase and a caricature, but he says the goal of NATO is to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down, right? And this is actually a pretty good tagline to remember. And that's, frankly, part of why, as Fyodor referenced yesterday, why was it that the British and the French were not necessarily that comfortable with German reunification, right? One of the premises of NATO and the whole institutional architecture of Europe, right, is that Germany should be, you know, perhaps economically strong, but not militarily, politically, and economically strong, because if that happens, Germany basically dominates Europe. And then, of course, by 1955, when the Warsaw Pact comes into being as an answer to NATO, it's very explicitly an answer to NATO. NATO comes first, then the Warsaw Pact. But what's interesting about this dynamic, and that is true to this day, or it is, let's just say, it's conceptually relevant to this day, that the existence of such a thing as a Soviet military alliance and a Soviet military threat to Western Europe becomes the raison d'etre for NATO. So NATO can simply point to that and say, well, this is why we exist, and of course, vice versa. You know, the basic elements of having an alliance, this is quite different from the European Union. Although NATO is often used as a proxy for the European Union, membership in Europe, membership in the West, in fact, it's radically different. It's about having a unified military command structure and standardization of military technology, i.e., can you fire French bullets in a German gun, right? Very simple. If you can't do that, and if the French and German commanders are not talking to each other, there's no way that they can fight together, divide and conquer, they will lose. So Secretary General of NATO is the top political official. It's currently Jens Stoltenberg, former Prime Minister of Norway. Am I correct about that? Yes, got it right? Norway?
Yes.
Yeah. And then the NATO High Military Command is always, so by the way, Secretary General of NATO is never an American, and the top military commander is always an American. Then this is one of those, it's actually not written into law, it's not part of the treaty, but it is simply one of those things you cannot change. And when we come to the OSCE, we will encounter even more of those things that you cannot change. So the NATO senior military commander, known as the SACEUR, Supreme Allied Commander Europe, by the way, which was Dwight Eisenhower's title. That's kind of cool. That's probably like the one like super cool title that is still left from World War II, which I would really love to have one day, except I'm not in the military, so it's not going to happen. But I think that's super cool. I always picture that. Did you ever see that? I think there's a publicity photo of Eisenhower on a horse with his helmet on and his, he was the only general in like 150 years to have 5 stars and a little ring on his helmet. It's so cool looking. He's the Supreme Allied Commander Europe. Anyway, and his headquarters is called SHAPE. I don't even know what it stands for. What does SHAPE stand for? Something Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, something like that. Anyway, it's outside of Brussels in Belgium, and the current guy is General Breedlove. So I said interchangeable. Interoperable, weapons, ammunition, systems, which nowadays actually more than bullets, right? That's a convenient way of thinking about it, but it's much more about like command and control, electronic warfare, basic military cultures. So you have NATO officers going to one another's war colleges, one another's staff colleges in order to be kind of conversant. And it entails sharing of nuclear weapons. This is a really big deal because, of course, you have 3 NATO members, which are nuclear powers, the United States, obviously, the United Kingdom, and France. And U.S.-owned nuclear weapons are essentially out on assignment. This is a very strange phenomenon. Our nuclear warheads, which are packaged in a certain kind of tactical delivery vehicle, mostly gravity bombs. Gravity bombs meaning you put them on an airplane, you let them go when the airplane's in the air, gravity causes them to fall down. So i.e. they're not smart bombs, they're not missiles, they're certainly not ICBMs. They are in 5 European countries still to this day, dating back many decades: Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Turkey, and Italy. And of course, until the INF Treaty, we used to have ICBMs that were intermediate range ICBMs that were based in Europe. We had famously the Jupiter missiles in Turkey, which were removed as part of the resolution to the Cuban Missile Crisis. But those tactical nuclear weapons are still in Europe and are a source of concern to the Russians. In 1959, the French kind of famously under de Gaulle withdraw from, not from NATO, but from the unitary command structure. Their theory being, we are not going to take orders from an American. You may call us politely, send us a calling card, and we may respond, and we may decide to fight along your side in case of a war, but we'll see. It was sort of just a matter of politics, but people often cite the French withdrawal. Of course, the French are back under the NATO unified command structure now. The Greeks, similarly, in 1980 withdrew, are also back. With the end of the Cold War in 1991, dissolution of the Warsaw Pact gives rise to the question, why have NATO? What's the rationale for NATO's existence? Well, that causes some pretty serious thinking and soul searching on the part of NATO, the United States in particular, and they come up with a few ideas and a few vehicles. One of which is the Partnership for Peace. The Partnership for Peace, this is a long and a huge and a fascinating story, but the Partnership for Peace is essentially a compromise device. And it's a compromise which is understood very differently on either side. It's understood very differently on the Russian side from the American side. On the American side, the message is, look, we, because of the open door, Article 10, because of our domestic politics, having lots of Central/Eastern European descent people, in voters in the United States who are critically important to both Bush and Clinton in Bush's reelection effort and then in Clinton's election and his reelection effort, we're not going to say no membership for Poland, no membership for the Czech Republic, then Czechoslovakia, which soon after became the Czech Republic, Hungary, etc. We can't say that. However, we do take seriously. We're not lying, and this is a to this day, it's a big sensitive issue between Moscow and Washington. We're not lying when we say we want Russia in Europe. We want Russia to be our ally. We want Russia to be our friend. And of course, Boris Yeltsin's message, Fyodor is exactly right about this at the time. His message is not that different from Russia's message today, which is you cannot create new dividing lines. You cannot simply move the boundary of NATO forward closer to Russia when we have gotten rid of our dividing lines from our side. We have gotten rid of the Warsaw Pact. We are no longer threatening you. You know, why do you continue to exist, much less expand? And so the Partnership for Peace is sort of a compromise vehicle. The idea is, well, everyone gets to join this thing, which is not quite NATO, but is not nothing. We will do some kinds of joint exercises. We will identify common priorities, fighting terrorism, for instance, managing the problems of migration and various 21st century security issues. And everybody will be a part of it. All the former Soviet states, the Central Asian countries even, which nobody talks about, the Central Asian countries in the European Union, for example, that just helps you understand why NATO is fundamentally differently focused. Let's not forget, right, NATO has operations in Afghanistan, so this is quite a different animal. We know, obviously, how this ends up today, not in such a happy place, but at the time, it's viewed as a reasonably workable compromise, and despite repeated concerns and objections from the Yeltsin administration, and even, by the way, in its early days from the Putin administration in Moscow, NATO enlargement moves forward. By the way, the term of art for NATO is always enlargement. One way that you can tell the difference between someone who kind of knows the NATO portfolio and someone who doesn't is that the people who don't always say expansion, which has to NATO people, it has a very negative connotation. The term of art is enlargement. Just know that. This is part of kind of institutional literacy. And the way that folks in Washington will tell this story even now, and I don't think that they're wrong, I've talked at great length with former Foreign Minister Kozarev about this, is that Russia definitely did not welcome NATO enlargement. But at the time, it understood it in a different context than it understands it today. And therefore, it didn't object to it as strenuously and with all of the tools and all of the consequences that it might have done had it thought about NATO the way that it does today. And that's important to understand because, of course, everything in international relations is a negotiation. And therefore, the United States and Western Europe did not view NATO enlargement as having such a bad cost, right? Well, the Russians seem like they can live with it. And in fact, the Russians can. And I should note that I think that there have been really some benefits to NATO enlargement for Russia. We, you know, it's a counterfactual to say what Europe would have looked like without a larger NATO, without a NATO that included all of these rounds of countries that joined in the years that you see above. I'll point out a couple of specifics. There are plenty of problematic issues that result from this, but one I think that is often taken for granted. Think about the historical rivalries between and among all of these former chunks of empires. The Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire. These people could have been killing each other just like the Yugoslavs were, you know, from day one of independence. But instead, they had their eyes on a bigger prize, which of course included the economic and free travel and political aspects of EU membership. But it also included the security assurances that come with NATO membership. And frankly, the ability of a higher and bigger power, which is the United States, to say to these people, get your act together, guys, Czechs and Slovaks, this had better be a peaceful divorce, otherwise forget about being part of our club. Or in the case of Hungarians and almost all of their neighbors, where they have major problems having to do with Hungary having once been a major hegemon in the region, having territorial claims on basically all of its neighbors. You know, we have problems with Hungary today, but I think the Russians should be grateful. I think Fyodor can say if they are or not, for some of the problems that we might have had that we did not throughout the 1990s and 2000s as a result of NATO being kind of a, let's just say, a kind of stabilizing and a homogenizing force across an otherwise extremely diverse part of Europe. But there are, of course, some very, very big problems that go with these rounds of NATO enlargement, one of which that I actually wrote about in the late 90s before it happened, was a warning that the intended accession of the three Baltic republics, so Poland, the first three to come in are, of course, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary. But the intended accession of the three Baltic republics creates this problem, the Kaliningrad problem. And I wrote about this in the late 1990s as being not necessarily an automatic casus belli for the Russians, that the Russians would go to war somehow, but that it would create dynamics down the road which we would really regret. And I think much more importantly than myself, George Kennan said that this would be a serious mistake. And I won't say necessarily that it has been a mistake, because again, I think in the case of the Baltic republics, these are countries that have incredibly complex histories of intra and inter regional and ethnic tensions, some of which I think have been moderated by their collective membership in NATO and the European Union, much to Russia and to everyone else's benefit. But the problems we face today have to do with, for example, the simple physical layout that to get to Kaliningrad over land, you have to cross over enemy territory, as seen by the Russians. So they have corridors that allow them to do that, but only by special agreement. You have to fly, for example, over international airspace, international waters. And you all may have read the article about a month ago when I believe it was a Polish, Fyodor, do you think, was it a Polish F-16 that flew off the wing of the Russian defense minister's airplane? Yeah. So a Polish NATO fighter jet has the bright idea about a month ago to do one of these near passes in the air on Defense Minister Shoigu's transport aircraft as he is flying from Moscow to Kaliningrad, right? And then a Russian interceptor, fully armed, as you would expect, comes in, gets in between the two aircraft, and does a maneuver to demonstrate that it's fully armed. I mean, this is insanity, right? This is an incredibly, incredibly dangerous situation, which exists because of this dynamic. By the way, historical note, why does Russia own Kaliningrad, which, as you can see, is sort of pretty close to Germany and Poland and all of that stuff? I mean, it's sort of, Gdansk is right here, so it's a Hanseatic kind of Baltic Sea trading city. There are various reasons, but the biggest one is that the Soviet Union viewed this particular territory as, of course, being strategically important. They certainly didn't trust the Poles or the Balts. But East Prussia and what used to be the city of Königsberg was actually one of the strongest bastions of Nazi Party support from the 1930s to the 1940s. And so the Soviet leadership viewed direct control rather than handing that territory over as part of Poland or part of Lithuania or something like that. They viewed direct control of that territory as being very important, and it is, of course, also a convenient operating base of non-frozen water on the Baltic Sea. Okay, NATO operations. Right, so I talked earlier about the Partnership for Peace. Yes, individual action plan countries. Now, yes, this is where things get a little bit tricky. So NATO establishes various speeds or tracks of relations with its entire neighborhood. The two really sticky and sensitive cases are two countries that I think, not coincidentally, have also in the last decade had wars with their bigger neighbor and with internal separatists. And that, of course, is Georgia and Ukraine. Recall that in 2008, the Bucharest summit, there is a debate between primarily Germany and the United States advocating NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine, the Germans largely leading the camp within NATO that is opposing it. And the compromise is the statement that Georgia and Ukraine will be NATO members, but without giving them a so-called membership action plan. A membership action plan essentially puts deadlines and conditions on both sides and says when and how it's going to happen. So in some ways, this is the worst of both worlds, right? Because it emboldens people like Mikhail Saakashvili, who thinks now that he has an American security guarantee. He acts as if he does, and he gets himself in huge trouble with the subsequent war in Georgia in August of 2008, where he begins shelling the Russian-supported separatist positions in South Ossetia and, of course, provokes a massive Russian military response, including entry into other parts of Georgian territory. So this is a legitimate war between Russia and Georgia. And then, of course, similarly, Ukraine, where there's the sense that, hey, we're clearly on the path. It actually kind of reinforces some of the identity problems that I talked about yesterday, a sense of kind of Ukrainian specialness. Like, obviously, of course, we're going to be in NATO. Look, we're the biggest country in Europe. We're so important as an outpost against the evil Russians and so on. And of course, this probably creates a very problematic dynamic, because what they didn't get was what all the other countries that actually joined NATO get, and that is that homogenizing, stabilizing effect and the ability of the United States and Germany and others to literally be there on the spot and say, no, you don't do this. You want to stay in our club? You don't do this. And I think that might have actually been, you know, it's completely counterfactual, but that might have actually been to everyone's benefit. All right, I mentioned lots of out-of-area operations. Fyodor has talked about the 1999 bombing of Belgrade, the operations in the Balkans. Obviously, NATO's been present in Afghanistan since 2001. This is the longest running NATO operation in history and is far removed from NATO's core territory. 2011, NATO operation bombs Libya. So there's kind of an emerging story for Russians in particular that NATO is basically becoming an alternative to the UN Security Council for the United States. So if the United States wants to act with a so-called coalition of the willing, it just uses its lapdogs in NATO to do so rather than going to the UN Security Council. Okay. I'm going to skip over. I was going to talk to you about some of the NATO strategic concepts, but let me skip to the 2014 Wales Summit. This is essentially the most recent significant NATO strategic concept, and as you can imagine, it is shaped almost overwhelmingly by the Ukraine crisis. A couple of lines from that document are all you need to hear to understand what it's about. Quote, Russia's aggressive actions against Ukraine have fundamentally challenged our vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace. Quote, we stand ready to act together and decisively to defend freedom and our shared values of individual liberty, human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. Quote, we aim to move towards the 2% guideline within a decade, that is 2% of GDP on defense spending, with a view to meeting NATO capability targets and filling NATO's capability shortfalls. Okay. So what all of this is saying is, after two decades of kind of wandering and uncertainty, what role does NATO play vis-a-vis the European Union? What role does NATO play vis-a-vis out-of-area threats like global terrorism, migration, climate change, whatever? Hey, baby, we're back. We are here to fight Russia, right? We are here to defend and deter against Russia. And importantly, because this has become a big issue with the Trump administration in the United States, we are going to commit to spend a lot of money to do so. And I'll just, as a side note, always follow the money. It's maybe an overly cynical way of looking at it, but when there are literally tens or hundreds of billions of dollars on the table, you get very, very powerful domestic political interest groups which are invested in the continuation of that narrative. And that is as much the case in the defense sector as it would be in any other part of the economy. Okay, last chunk. This one I thought you might enjoy. Remember I told you about the Flying Hussars? That's these guys, or this is like a reenactment of them anyway, Polish knights. And then this one is really great. So there's a sense in which Russians, I feel like, often have two coexisting but contradictory perceptions of what NATO in essence is. One is that the kind of sinister United States is using NATO as an instrument and is pulling the strings and moving pieces on the chessboard. But the other, which is contradictory to that, of course, is that the United States is kind of a big friendly lunk, which is being like actually manipulated by these cynical East Europeans who have always wanted to harm and destroy Russia. And it's stuff like this, the multinational trilateral brigade of all of Russia's best friends, the Lithuanians, the Poles, and the Ukrainians, with the, all of their wonderful historical stuff. And remember, I told you about the commandant of the NATO Defense College, who is a Polish knight, right? I mean, a Polish major general with his suit of armor and everything. I mean, this stuff resonates with Russians in a really negative way. Okay, OSCE, and I promise I'll wrap up. All right, so OSCE comes out of the so-called Helsinki process, which is at that time known as the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, roughly 1972 to 1975. 35 nations participate in this conference, and they all have different goals in coming to the table, but of course they're dominated by two blocks, a U.S.-led Western bloc and a Soviet-led Eastern bloc. This is even possible in the first place. So this is the height of the Cold War, right? 1970s, like, how is this possible? Well, the key term here is détente, right? The essence of détente is, after a series of almost inconceivably dangerous moments of the Cold War, right? The Berlin crisis, through the Cuban Missile Crisis, the proxy wars in the Middle East, Vietnam, all of these things, only Afghanistan had not happened yet. There's a realization on the part of both leaderships that, you know, these kind of absolutist or maximalist visions of what success means are probably not achievable. It's not just mutually assured nuclear destruction, but just the idea, you know, we probably have to accept that within our lifetimes, we are not going to fully defeat one another. Therefore, if we have to live with each other, we probably should come up with some basic rules of how we should behave towards one another. And that's really it. That is the great insight of détente. And it kind of works. But it only works with an effort like the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. So the Soviets have a certain set of goals in coming to the table. The West has another set of goals, and they interact in a very interesting way, which results in the Decalogue of Principles that you all now have. The Soviet goal is to largely to solidify its post-World War II territorial presence in Eastern Europe, and the physical boundaries that had been drawn, in some cases by agreement among the Allied powers, with almost no say from the actual countries concerned, some of which lost huge amounts of territory or removed 500 miles this way or that way, shifts of population, et cetera, to just sort of ratify the political military reality of post-World War II in Eastern Europe. And the West's goal is a little bit different, which is to put human rights, migration issues, to some extent economic issues, all of which have been major sources. Remember the captive nations movement that I pointed out to you with the statue of Taras Shevchenko? These have been huge issues on the Western agenda, but the Soviet answer to them for 30 years has been sovereignty. These are all domestic matters. Stay the hell out of our backyard. So what's interesting is in the final act, which you also have in front of you, There are three basic baskets or dimensions addressed, and they cross, they sort of run the gamut of all of these concerns. So the political military dimension that's about basic sort of that is about what we think of as classic notions of security, that basically ratifies the Soviet drawn borders in Eastern Europe. So you could think of that in a way as a big Western concession. I think we don't think about it that much today, but I think at the time, the fact that the West was preserving a few objections, like with the independence of the Baltic states, but basically saying, hey, the rest of it's okay. That was a big deal. The notion of economics is playing a role in security. I think it's hugely important, especially as we come into the 21st century globalization, the information economy. We see that around us all the time, everything from cybersecurity to migration of labor and market access. And then the third basket, of course, human security. And this is the one that is taken home as the big win for the United States. This is the big win that we get to say, no, we now have in black and white with your signature, not legally binding, I'll say a word about that in a moment, but nonetheless with your political support, Moscow, we have proof that issues of human rights are what come to be known in the 1970s and 80s as human rights, are legitimate matters of international security. This is a huge insight and a radical departure. Even though you did have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as part of the UN founding, it really basically was not viewed as a matter of international security for 30 years until Helsinki. And this, by the way, gives rise to Helsinki commissions in many of the participating states, including the United States, where it's actually an instrument of the U.S. Congress, and then it, and then sort of more informal bodies, Helsinki monitors, people who basically do human rights activism with a kind of cloak of protection and legitimacy, thanks to the Helsinki Final Act. Very, very important. So the other document that you have in front of you reflects kind of where this process comes to 15 years later, and that's the Paris Charter, the Charter of Paris for a New Europe. That is what turns this sort of ongoing discourse, this ongoing process called the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, into an organization called the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Very conveniently, gives it a headquarters in Vienna, in the former Imperial Palace, the Hofburg, which is a super beautiful place, but doesn't give it legal personality in the way that, for example, the United Nations does. So legal personality is a kind of technical term that's important to know, you know, not important to understand all the technical details. Just to understand that, like, when you're a UN employee or a World Bank employee or even a NATO employee, you can travel on a passport that is issued by that organization. That organization is, in many respects, like a country. It is given the regard and the status by all of the other governments of a sovereign entity or a semi-sovereign entity in the international system. The OSCE doesn't have any of that. Anybody who's acting on the OSCE's behalf or in the context of an OSCE mission, And I'll say more about this. There are tons of such people, right? You heard about the special monitors in eastern Ukraine, some of whom have gotten killed or kidnapped. The thing is, those guys are not carrying OSCE passports. They have OSCE credentials, but it's a piece of paper. I've had it before. It's nothing. It gives you no protection. They're carrying their national passports, which means that all the time they're accused of being spies, they're told that their visa paperwork is inadequate, they're told that, you know, their country doesn't have appropriate agreements with the country that they're going to. So the lack of legal personality for the OSCE is not a non-issue. It's a significant issue. And yet OSCE is the only fully inclusive Euro-Atlantic organization. It's the only one, certainly the only one that focuses on Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian, I should say, that focuses on security issues. And it's generally very little known here in North America, and even in Western Europe. It's become more known because of the Ukraine crisis. It tends to be much better known in the East because of what it does, that it focuses on, of course, peace and security issues. So it has missions in each of the key conflict regions, the Transnistria conflict, Nagorno-Karabakh, the various Balkan conflicts. Its biggest mission for the longest time was in Kosovo. Now its biggest mission, of course, is the special monitoring mission in Ukraine. And it does election monitoring, election observation. But believe it or not, they observe American elections. We tend not to notice them, but they're there. Including Russian observers who are part of OSCE, and American observers. You're always seconded. I've been part of this. You're always seconded. So you still carry your national passport. You know, you just have a little piece of paper that says, I'm an OSCE election observer. And that's why they tend to be well known in former Soviet countries, because they tend to give reports that are less favorable about those elections. Okay. Structure. You really don't need to know this. But I show it to you as an example of how complex even a non-legal personality organization can be. There is a secretariat, which is led by a secretary general. In fact, it's no longer Lamberto Zanier, who was an Italian diplomat. He has moved over, which is very strange, actually quite unprecedented. He has moved over to a lower ranking position called High Commissioner for National Minorities, and he will be replaced, I believe the compromise has been by a Swiss diplomat called, what's his name? I just blanked. Anyway, and the reason this is important is because, like with NATO, right, there's an agreement. It's never going to be an American Secretary General. It's also never going to be a Russian Secretary General. In general, it is one of the smaller countries. And then there are these various kind of high representative positions which have specific subject matter billets. Probably the most important of them is, oh dear, the Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights, which is based in Warsaw, which does election observation. You also have the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly, which is largely symbolic, but because of the role of the Helsinki Commission in the U.S. Congress, which tends to be closely associated with the Parliamentary Assembly. It is a way of getting some quite powerful American and other, including European, parliamentarians engaged on OSCE topics. The reason that I referred to the selection of the Secretary General as kind of a negotiation is because it is exactly that. All OSCE decisions, whether they're taken at the summit level — what does summit level mean? It's a technical concept. Summit, right? Highest peak. So that means presidents, heads of state. If you don't have heads of state participating, it's not a summit. So never refer — you'll sound silly if you want to sound educated. Always refer, never refer to a meeting of foreign ministers as a summit. That's not a summit meeting, okay? The ministerial council, that is a meeting of foreign ministers, or the permanent council, which is the meeting of ambassadors who are credentialed to the OSCE in Vienna. So these folks meet on regular basis, sometimes every couple of years in the case of a summit, annually in the case of the ministerial, and weekly in the case of the permanent council. But in each case, they can only take decisions by consensus. That means if there's one out of 57 OSCE participating states, if there's even one of them that disagrees, they can't move. And that's the reason why selection of a Secretary General was so controversial, as you would imagine, over the last year. Everybody knew Zanier was going to be leaving. He was term limited out a month or so ago. But for years, it was unclear. I mean, how could they get to consensus? There's zero agreement between Russia and the United States, let alone everybody else, on all of the important issues in all three baskets of the OSCE. And I hope we'll be talking about this in our simulation. I have to say, I haven't had a chance to talk to people yet to find out sort of what kind of deals were struck. But my understanding is that there is a deal, and they have not only a Secretary General, this Swiss ambassador, but they have people to fill each of these several top high representative positions, which had also been held vacant. And they've been vacant in some cases for years because we couldn't reach consensus about who to put into them. Okay. There are various other sort of centers and instrumentalities of OSCE. The important ones are called mechanisms. So mechanisms are basically when the OSCE participating states get together and they look at the set of problems that they have, they say, you know, we can't just meet in a summit every time there's a problem, because all we're going to do is yell at each other. Can we agree in advance? And this is the thing that we, as sort of students of international relations, we often think, hey, we can do this. We have these great insights. If we can just put this stuff down in paper and agree to it in advance, we can prevent conflict, or we can respond quickly to conflict and resolve it when it arises. And so, in fact, that instinct is not far off from the reality of what these international diplomats try to do. So let me give you three examples. There's a so-called Moscow mechanism, which is named that because it was agreed at a ministerial meeting in Moscow. And that is to, in case of some type of issue, some type of security problem in the region, it is the appointment of a rapporteur who will investigate with or without the consent of the target country. And that's incredibly important, because if you take, for example, the 2010 Belarus presidential elections, where 600 people are beaten up and arrested on the square, a rapporteur is appointed without the consent of Belarus. So that's an interesting case where the OSCE is taking some action without consensus. But then here's the problem of the organization not having legal personality. This guy, who's a French academic called Emmanuel Decaux, he's not allowed into Belarus. So how do you investigate? How do you be a rapporteur if you're not allowed into the country? Right? Now, in principle, the Belarusians, it's their country. If they wanted to block a UN official from coming in, they could do it. But if you come in on a UN passport and a country says no, you start to look like North Korea, more even than Belarus, which already looks pretty bad. So this is a sense in which the mechanism's a pretty good idea, right? To appoint a rapporteur if essentially you have consensus minus one. But in practice, it doesn't work without legal personality. The other is called the Vienna mechanism, and this is about conflict prevention. This is a lot of the things that are about sort of good practices are named for Vienna. So the Vienna conventions, the Vienna document, which is about military transparency, and the Vienna mechanism. So just say Vienna and people will think you're really smart. It's about exchanging information in case of an apparent brewing crisis. Now, obviously, it didn't work in the case of the Ukraine crisis or the Georgia crisis. But in principle, the idea is we're not going to radically change any party's interests, but this sort of fog of war, right, that happens. Remember this, I mean, in the early days of the Ukraine crisis, this couldn't be a better example, right? What the hell is going on? Nobody knows, right? We're getting false information from all over the place, denial that, you know, there are Russian troops in Crimea, and then confirmed later, oh yeah, by the way, they were Russian troops and they all get medals, right? You know, I mean, so the whole idea of the Vienna mechanism is about exchanging information, putting it out there in a reliable format in an explicit OSCE context. Okay. Role of OSCE in Ukraine. As I said, the special monitoring mission has become the largest OSCE presence. It's several thousand people. It's headed by a Turkish ambassador. Its deputy head, Alexander Hug, is probably more visible, more active. It's been there since April of 2014. Their observers have been taken hostage in the past, later released, as was pictured here. Their mandate is essentially to report, right, to observe and report security, civil society, ceasefire, etc. And they also administer what's called the trilateral contact group of Ukraine, Russia, and the separatists under OSCE auspices, which in my view is probably in practice is the beginning of something like a 5+2, which is the mechanism for the Transnistria conflict, or a Minsk group, which is the mechanism for the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, simply because I personally, I don't, you know, we're going to talk way more about this next week, I don't really see this conflict being resolved. I see it being managed. And OSCE is actually a very good vehicle for conflict management. Okay. I told you I would say a little something about the Euro-Atlantic security community. I think I haven't left myself time to do that because I want to get to Fyodor's remarks. So why don't we just let Fyodor introduce the concept, and then we'll talk about this more in discussion. So, yeah.
I think it's better for you too.
You want? Okay. All right.
I'll tell about it, and I'll tell about it.
Okay, I mean, so basically, the notion of a Euro-Atlantic security community, I'm going to do this quickly, it's not a specific institution, it's much more of a conceptual idea. It jumps off from the Europe whole, free, and at peace, and it asks the basic question of, you know, do we actually have a community? Do we have a commonality of interests? Are we able to identify some common basis on which all of us, right, the whole OSCE space, but in particular, of course, Russia, Europe, and North America, have a common interest in dealing with threats, challenges, opportunities, everything, energy, protracted conflicts, movement of people and trafficking of goods, politics of identity and memory and history, institutions, competition among other institutions, like on the one hand NATO and the EU, on the other hand the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Leaders on both sides have talked about it. They frequently talk about something called a Euro-Atlantic or a Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian security community, but does it exist? And if it does, how would we define it? And I'll just read you the line from this initiative called EASY, the Euro-Atlantic Security Initiative that Fyodor and I worked on, which declared the following, and this was supported by a bunch of super high-level former officials from all sides. By a Euro-Atlantic security community, we mean an inclusive, undivided security space free of opposing blocs and gray areas. Within this space, disputes would be expected to be resolved exclusively by diplomatic, legal, or other nonviolent means, without recourse to military force or the threat of its use. All would be bound together by a shared understanding of the major security challenges facing member states and would be ready to respond to them with effective organization and action. Now, if you break down this concept, you get three basic principles. And by the way, so this is supported by a bunch of very high-level people, and this statement is made in between the Georgia crisis and the Ukraine crisis, so roughly 2010. Number one, that disputes within the community have to be resolved without the use or threat of force, consistent with the UN Charter. It's not rocket science. Number two, that there is a need for regional cooperation around a common purpose or set of comparable values. And number three, that members of the community should exercise sensitivity with respect to one another's security concerns in order to build a high degree of trust necessary to periodically put their shared interests ahead of competition. By the way, if you remember the Medvedev security treaty that Fyodor talked about yesterday, and if you read that treaty, that is almost exactly the content of that treaty. It's very vague, it's very mushy, but the concept is very important. Now, here's the problem. It's what I call the cycle of distrust problem. How can we depend on one another for mutual security if we don't trust one another in the first place? But why do we not trust each other? Because we don't have mutual security in the first place, right? So you're caught in this cycle. You don't trust each other because you feel insecure vis-a-vis one another. How can we feel secure if we have no trust as a basis to build security? How do you fix the problem? Maybe 7 years ago, I would have felt like, you know, we could write a 60-page report and that would fix the problem. Obviously, I don't feel that way now. The OSC is clearly only part of the solution. It's one of these necessary but not sufficient parts. It is the only inclusive organization. Inclusivity is vital, right? I know from experience, you're not going to solve the problem by saying, well, let's only include the good guys in the security treaty. If we do that, everything's going to be fine. Well, no, by definition, you're going to have a problem with whoever you left out, and probably with some of the people that you left in. Clearly, linking different concepts of security is important, right? We can't just define security in a political military way. We have to recognize the economic, the social, all the other dimensions to it. Clearly, the solution doesn't lie in throwing the baby out with the bathwater. NATO is imperfect. For sure, NATO is imperfect. The EU is imperfect. Russia's Collective Security Treaty Organization is imperfect. But throwing these things out and saying, you know, the problem is NATO, so let's get rid of NATO, I think would be very, very stupid. OSCE can do more. Clearly, we need rules of the road. I hope that the point of our simulation on Friday will be that all of you guys who have way more energy and I hope get more sleep than I do, you know, can bring some creativity to this problem. I don't expect you to solve it. It would be awesome if you can come up with something and we have a signing ceremony. But we clearly need some new rules of the road. Why don't I leave it there? And why don't we take a 10-minute break before Fyodor takes over?